You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
2% of trips in Greater Vancouver are made by bicycle. That's compared with 35% in Munster in Germany. In the last 35 years, European cities have experienced a renaissance in cycling, while we have remained constant despite spending millions of dollars. The difference is the consequence of government policies and commitment to infrastructure. John Pooker is a professor of urban planning at Rutgers University and has studied policies that actually encourage cycling, and that's in Europe. His presentation, Cycling for Everyone, Lessons for Vancouver from the Netherlands, Denmark and Germany, was at SFU Downtown on June 24th. You can find a link to his accompanying slideshow with graphs and some pretty great photos of European cycling infrastructure via a link on our website at corpradio.org/redeye.
To present to you some ideas of policies and programs that cities in Germany, in the Netherlands, and in Denmark use to promote cycling, to make cycling safe, convenient, attractive, and possible for everyone. And when I say everyone, I mean everyone. For women as well as men, for the young, for the old, for the middle-aged, for adolescents, even for people to some extent with disabilities, to the extent that it's possible. We need to also facilitate cycling for people with disabilities, various income levels, various degrees of skills. So that is certainly the goal that is set by cities and also by the countries themselves. In the Netherlands, in Denmark, and in Germany. Cycling is not seen there as being just for young men. It is not seen as being something for people with a very high degree of physical ability. It is not seen as being something for people who are extremely risky. They love cycling on busy streets with lots of traffic. It is seen as being something as a practical way to get around, sure, for recreation as well, but for the most part, for daily travel, for going shopping, for going to school, for visiting friends, for the whole range of daily activities. So these Dutch, Danish, German cities, they really set as a goal making cycling possible for everyone. And I would argue, as you might know, TransLink is now coming up with a new bike plan for the metropolitan area here in Vancouver. And I would argue that one of the most appropriate goals in that plan would in fact be to make cycling possible for everyone, convenient, make people comfortable cycling, whether you're old or young, whether you're a woman or a man, no matter what your social status might be. So on the one hand, I think that ought to be one goal, making cycling possible for everyone. And at the same time, by the way, by making cycling possible for everyone, you're also going to increase the overall share of trips by bike. I don't know of a single country anywhere in the world that has an extremely high level of cycling where cycling is not for everyone. And so if you want to achieve the goal of a high overall mode share of bikes, then you also have to achieve simultaneously the goal of making cycling possible for everyone. So this is why I put this forth as the title of the presentation. It's also, I suppose, expresses one of my own value judgments. I really am very, very passionately dedicated to environmental sustainability and to social justice. And I think as part of this aspect of social justice, I think it's really, really important to make cycling possible for everyone. Another possible title for this presentation would be Everyone for Cycling. And it's important to get the support of everyone in society for cycling because you need that political and public support to get the financing, to get the space, to get the time, to get traffic priority, for example, at various intersections for cyclists, to take away car lanes and turn them into bicycling paths, to take away car parking and turn it into bike parking. You really need a tremendous amount of public support for that to occur. And that is one of the keys to the success of cycling policies and programs in Dutch, German, and Danish cities. There are many, many, many strategies we need to all be thinking about and promoting and marketing to the public as a whole as to why everyone should be in favor of cycling. And it's really important. For one thing, Cycling is one of a range of alternatives to the car that improves mobility options for everyone. It means you're less likely. It's just one more thing. You can walk, you can cycle, you can take public transportation. It's one of the three environmental modes of transportation. And it increases our ability to avoid car dependence. It gives us yet one more alternative, especially for medium distance trips, say 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers, 3, 4 kilometers. For many people, that might seem a little bit too far to walk, but it's a perfect distance for cycling, say between 1, 3, 4 kilometers. And so by making cycling convenient and safe, it really does. And especially to the extent that you make it possible for all segments of society, it really does give everyone increased mobility options. And so I would argue that the public as a whole and politicians should support cycling because it really does enrich the mobility options for everybody. Second, it's certainly by making conditions safer for cyclists, by removing cars from the street, by discouraging people driving through the centers of cities and through residential neighborhoods, it's certainly going to make our neighborhoods safer and more livable as well. Public health, one of Larry's areas here. Clearly, there's no question, both in Canada and in the United States, we desperately need to integrate more physical activity into our daily lifestyles. You cannot depend on people going to the gym or using the exercise equipment they have in their basements on a daily basis. It's just not going to happen. You will always find an excuse not to go to the gym, not to use the exercise equipment, not to go to the track. But if you, on an everyday basis, are cycling to get to work, to go to shopping, to visit friends, or for whatever reason, you're going to automatically get that physical activity, and it's going to give you improved mental health, physical health. It's great for you. So in that respect as well, it's great for public health, and that's something that the public as a whole and politicians should be supporting. And not only does it directly improve public health, it then reduces healthcare costs. So even as taxpayers or as contributors to medical insurance plans, you're benefiting even if you are not cycling yourself. If you can increase the percentage of trips by cycling, you're going to increase overall health levels and reduce healthcare expenditures. Obviously, environmental advantages. If you're cycling, you're not really creating any air pollution or water pollution, environmental impacts of any kind, destruction of ecosystems, almost nothing used in the way of non-renewable resources in making or using a bike. Reduce traffic congestion, reduce parking needs, reduce energy use. Wow! Those are a lot of weapons in your arsenal to get that public and political support, and you need to use every single one of them. We really do need more funding, more space for our cycling facilities to really make them first class, a real network of cycling facilities. But you need to use all of these arguments. I really am convinced we haven't done enough to get this message through to the public and to politicians to get that truly widespread public and political support for cycling. And then the last one, remember Kyoto? We seem to have forgotten it in the United States. I think you're much more onto it here in Canada, but it's clearly one thing that we need to work on. I mean, if for no other reason, and there's many, many, many reasons, but it's certainly one of, you know, 8, 10, whatever reasons for why the public as a whole should in fact be supporting cycling. Now, the good news is there's lots of potential for increased cycling. Many, many, many trips here in Greater Vancouver are short enough to cover by bike. I mean, each individual has different distances you're willing or able to cycle, but we're talking about roughly a third to a fourth of all trips right here in Greater Vancouver are certainly short enough to cycle. You have a third of all trips shorter than 3 kilometers, a fourth of all trips shorter than 2 kilometers. Those are really easy distances to bike. So the good news is there's a huge potential for more cycling here in Greater Vancouver. And the other good news is, and I will show you this, I've already claimed it several times, but the other good news is almost everyone has the potential to cycle, both the physical and I suppose even the mental potential to cycle. It's certainly possible at almost every age, and I'll again show you this later that it's true. It is physically possible at almost every age. Women can certainly cycle as well as men. And if you don't believe that, I'll show you some really great women cyclists. I mean, women can cycle every bit as well as men, if not better. Cycling is possible for a wide range of skills. You do not have to be Lance Armstrong to get on a bike. You really don't. Maybe some people are going to cycle very slowly for short distances. That's fine. But there's a wide range of skills that allow you to cycle in different conditions. And it's also certainly affordable by anyone. I don't know anyone who's gone broke. I guess you could buy a really expensive bike and then have it stolen several times. But for the most part, you can get a bike for a very, very low amount of money, and it certainly doesn't cost much to operate and to maintain. So it's certainly, in that respect, it's very socially sustainable. That is, bicycling is something that is possible and affordable by a very wide range of the population, and that's what I would define as social sustainability. So we already know it's very environmentally sustainable, but it's also socially sustainable, and it's also economically sustainable. These are the three dimensions of sustainability: economically sustainable, environmentally sustainable, and then socially sustainable. And at every single index, cycling is just about the most sustainable of all your transportation modes. But unfortunately, we don't do enough of it in North America. We do even less in the United States than here in Canada. You're at about 2%. The United States is actually somewhat less than 1%. But as you look at these different countries, the main point I suppose I'd like to make with this slide is to show you just how much potential there is for increased cycling. Rather than looking at it from a depressing point of view, ooh, Canada's so low, look at it, ooh, you could go so much higher. Let's look at it a positive way. Look at the Netherlands, 27% trips by bike, and if you look at just local trips, it's 35%, and in some cities it goes up to 45%. In Denmark, we have about 20% of all trips by bike. Look at Germany, Belgium, Finland, roughly 10 to 12% of trips by bike. These countries are not poor countries. These are not developing countries. They are not backward countries. They are not technologically undeveloped countries. Danes and Germans and the Dutch are cycling because cycling there is fast, convenient. It is a practical and safe way to get around. They can afford cars. They are not cycling because they are poor. And the reason that they're cycling is because the policies and the programs that are in place in their cities make cycling a practical and feasible thing to do. But again, I would just like, just look at the difference there. It's a difference of 10 to 1, 30 to 1 in some cases, much, much, much higher levels of cycling in these northern European countries in particular. And so that might lead you to ask the question, well, what are those countries doing that makes so much more cycling possible? And I'll go through those policies. Now, the other thing I wanted to note here is some of you might think, as I really think, that cycling to me is really only successful when it really does make it possible for all groups of society. And so when I see a lot of women cycling, I'm thinking, well, that's a good indicator. And in fact, in this slide, this is my colleague Susan Handy at the University of California, Davis, took this shot last summer in Copenhagen. And you can see there's more women than men cycling there. I mean, they could be, and they, no one's wearing a helmet, by the way. I'll make a comment about that later. But you'll see no one's wearing a helmet. I mean, these are, there's no special Lycra. They're not riding fancy bikes. Those are perfectly normal people. They could be your next door neighbor, your friend, your wife, your daughter, your mother, grandmother. Well, I guess you're not your grandmother. They don't look like grandmothers to me. But at any rate, clearly, in places such as Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, women cycle every bit as much as men. And in fact, in the Netherlands, they cycle even more. 55% of all bike trips in the Netherlands, in fact, are by women. In Germany, it's 49%. In Denmark, it's 45%. So, but roughly, just say 50-50. Roughly, as many women as men cycle. If you look at Canada, it's 30%. The United States is even lower at 25%, and then really low in Australia, 21%. I guess in Australia, cycling is more of a macho sort of a thing. But at any rate, again, just to show you that those of you who think that cycling is inevitably more for men than for women, it's just wrong. It depends on the facilities you provide. And if you provide safe and convenient cycling facilities, you will get as many women cycling as men. In terms of age groups, you can certainly start cycling at a very young age. and continue to do it until you're very old. And I got to tell a story now, and then I'll tell you, show you the next graph. The man, and his name is Cor van der Klauw, who's the bicycling coordinator of Groningen in the Netherlands, said, I want you to tell everyone in your audience that my mother is 94 years old, and she cycles every day to do her shopping, and it's about a kilometer back and forth to the shopping because she thinks it's a waste of energy to get there any other way. So those of you who think you can't cycle when you're over 90, you're wrong. And in fact, this next graphic demonstrates that sort of with numbers. You can see here, if you look at Germany, Denmark, the Netherlands, very high percentages of the Germans, the Danes, and the Dutch elderly actually cycle. If you look in Germany, what's really astounding here is as Germans get older and older, in fact, they make a higher and higher percentage of their trips by bike. Look at Denmark. It falls somewhat from 17% down to 12%. In the Netherlands, it goes up again from 22% to 24%. Clearly, the most cycling, the highest percentage of trips by bike, is in the lowest age category. But then, after you get sort of middle age and getting older and older, I think it's just astounding at how much higher the percentage of bike trips gets as people get older. Perhaps the most astounding thing in this entire graphic, and it's one of my favorites, so that's why I'm spending so much time on it. But if you look at the Dutch elderly, 24% of all trips by the Dutch elderly are by bike. Now just consider that. 1/4 of all trips by the Dutch elderly, 65 and older, are by bike. In Denmark, 12%. Germany, 12%. Clearly, it is not the case that getting old means you can't bike. It's an important, very important source of mobility, of independence, of physical activity. I think in every respect, it's really important to give people this mobility option as they get older. And the most important demographic change in our societies, in all of North America, also in Europe, by the way, is the aging of our societies. A higher and higher percentage of our populations are older than 65, older than 75, older than 85. And we need to be thinking about what kind of mobility options we're going to give those elderly people. And I know when I get older, I want to be able to walk and to still cycle and take public transportation and not be dependent on the automobile, which would be impossible anyway because I can't drive. At any rate, one of the key approaches that these German, Dutch, and Danish cities take to making cycling possible for everyone is by making it safe. It's absolutely key. If you do surveys of the general population and you ask them, why don't you cycle? The number one reason by far is the perception that cycling is unsafe. This is particularly true among the elderly, among the parents of children, among women. And this is what the surveys, and what they most want, when you ask them, what would most make you cycle? The answer always, in about 80% of the cases, is give us separated facilities. Help us get away some degree of protection from the motor vehicle traffic. Give us good parking facilities. Connect us to public transportation. Give us good sort of interchanges with public transportation. But above all, give us safe places to cycle. So anyway, increasing the safety of cycling and increasing the perceived safety of cycling is absolutely crucial in cycling policies. Now, you can look at this either positively or negatively. Traffic safety, cycling safety here in Canada is almost 3 times greater than it is in the United States. This is showing the cycling fatality rates per 100 million kilometers cycled, but it's still about twice what you have in the Netherlands and Denmark. So you could make cycling a lot safer. So on the one hand, you can sort of say, well, we're doing a lot better than the United States, which is true. You have more cycling and safer cycling. And again, I think the two things go hand in hand. But you could do a lot better. Cycling could be at least twice as safe as it is now, because you can see how much safer it is there in the Netherlands and in Denmark. Now, this is a rather controversial topic, the next one, because I know here in British Columbia there is a helmet law, and adults as well as children, everyone is required to wear a helmet when cycling. And I personally, when I cycle in New Jersey or anywhere in the United States, I also wear a helmet. But I can tell you, the Dutch don't wear helmets, not even the children. The Danes don't wear helmets, and a very, very small percentage, 5 or 10%, even maybe not even that, of Germans wear helmets. So they have much higher degrees of safety in those countries without wearing helmets. So at least in those countries, the key to greater cycling safety does not appear to be the helmets, but rather much, much safer cycling facilities. I must say, I mean, it's a little bit controversial here, I know, but the director of cycling for the city of Amsterdam, also for the city of Groningen, and for the nationwide cycling federation, all said, we're so much against helmet use law because we feel they discourage cycling. They're not against helmet use, but they are, for whatever reason that you can agree with or disagree with, they're against helmet use law, so whatever. I think interesting statistic here. This was a city, Münster, Germany, where I lived for 2.5 years. It's the most cycling-oriented city in all of Germany, about a third of all trips by bike. No one wears helmets, but they have the most extensive and most separate cycling facilities of any German city. And look at the result here. One cycling injury per roughly 600,000 trips. Not a fatality, an injury. One injury per 600,000 bike trips. Given that statistic, you can understand why everyone in Münster perceives cycling as being totally safe. And perhaps because of that reason, no one wears a helmet. But again, totally aside from your views on helmets, I just think it's astounding how safe you can make cycling. That really is the point I would like to make with this slide. Cycling can be extremely safe if you do the right things. Moreover, it turns out, a colleague of mine, Peter Jacobson in California, has done, and a number of people as well, Terry Rutter at Oxford University, have done studies, and they've shown that as cycling levels increase, cycling becomes safer and safer. As cycling levels decrease, cycling becomes less and less safe. So that if we succeed here, for example, in metropolitan Vancouver, to reach this goal of, I think it's 5% trips by bike, currently we're about 2%, it's almost inevitable that cycling will become safer. There are two reasons for this. I'm still oversimplifying here, but one reason is the more people who are cycling, the higher the likelihood that a motorist will at some time or other also have been on a bike and be more sensitive to the needs of cyclists and drive with more consideration and care vis-a-vis cyclists. The other reason is, as more and more people cycle, you have more demand and also supply of the necessary cycling facilities, whether that be separate bike paths, bike lanes, bike parking, and so forth. But anyway, this is a very, very important concept, I think, because those of us who are advocating more cycling often get criticized by saying, well, you're, on the one hand, you're showing us a safety problem here. There's a relatively high traffic fatality rate among cyclists, and yet you're advocating more cycling. What are you really advocating? But the point is, you have to understand, if we succeed in raising the cycling mode share, we're inevitably going to reduce the fatality rate and make cycling safer overall. Moreover, there was a study done in Great Britain which showed that whatever the traffic dangers in terms of public health of cycling fatalities and injuries, they are offset by a ratio of at least 10 to 1 by the health benefits of cycling. So I'm not saying cycling is perfectly safe, but even given the less than perfect cycling facilities we have now and the behavior of motorists, even given those negative situations, that the health benefits, the cardiovascular health benefits of cycling are so great that they exceed by a ratio of 10 to 1 the risks of cycling. So again, think about that. Now, what did these European cities do to promote cycling and make it safer? They completely reversed their public policies in the 1970s. There had been a huge decline in cycling. Many of you probably assume, well, cycling's been booming in Europe forever and forever and forever. It's just not true. If you look at the 1950s, 1960s, huge declines in cycling, 70%, 80%, in some countries even 90% declines in cycling. Why? Because of the increase in car ownership, increase in car use, expansion of roadways, and really nothing being done to facilitate walking or cycling, a neglect of the public transit, no efforts to integrate these various green modes of transportation. Then what happened in the 1970s in every single one of these countries, at the city level, at the state level, and at the national level, a complete turnaround of policies, increasing year by year by year by year, more and more auto restraint policies, restrictions of car parking, traffic calming of residential neighborhoods, car-free zones, more and more of them, and bigger areas of the car-free zones. At the same time, so those are the stick policies, the auto restraint policies. On the other hand, vastly improving public transportation systems, bikeway systems, pedestrian systems, and in particular in terms of cycleways, we have, again, many of you think, well, the Netherlands was always perfect for bicycling. Not true. They had a tripling in their bikeway network between the 1970s and the 1990s. They didn't have the appropriate facilities back in the 1970s. They tripled the extent of their bikeway network. In Germany also, they tripled the kilometers of their bikeway network and vastly improved it year by year. Even now, they are not sitting on their laurels. Every single year in every single German city I know, in every Dutch city, in every Danish city, they're constantly trying to figure out how can we make these facilities better. And as a result of doing this, by the way, they dramatically increased levels of cycling. These are various German cities, and if you look at the next to the last column here, you can see that these are large cities. Munich is probably almost 2 million people. They more than doubled the mode share of cycling, more than doubled in Nuremberg. They doubled it in Cologne and so forth. So even in really large German cities, Munich is probably just about the same sort of population size, metropolitan area as Vancouver. I mean, imagine you're trying to achieve a goal of going from 2% to 5%, and look what they did in Munich. They went from 6% to 13%. It's a huge increase. And then probably even bigger increase in the total number of bike trips, but even in the bike share, it's more than a doubling in the share of trips by bike. So this is a really dramatic accomplishment. And I want to sort of illustrate just how dramatic the shift in policy was. This is a city here, it's called Lörrach in southwest Germany. It's pretty near Basel, Switzerland, actually. But this is the view of the city in 1953 before the onslaught of automobiles, and you can see lots of people cycling. And notice that well right there, because it's key in the shot. So this was the 1953 before all the cars came. This is what it looked like in 1970, exactly the same intersection, and that's that same fountain. Ugly, ugly, ugly. Car oriented. You see one cyclist, and otherwise it's sort of dominated by cars, a very unpleasant urban environment. 2006, exact same intersection. That's the fountain. Look at that. No more cars. They've made it into a car-free zone. You see lots and lots of bicycles parked there at the bike at the fountain and all along this pedestrian zone. I might also note, I know there's some opposition to car-free zones here in Vancouver. There was a lot of opposition in almost every one of these cities initially as well. All the merchants said, no, you're going to drive us out of business. We're going to go bankrupt. We're going to lose all our customers. Our customers will insist on getting to us door-to-door by car. And instead, what they found was they had booming business. And the retailers that were outside the car-free zone demanded to be included in the car-free zone as well. So it just shows that there's this sort of a false perception that car-free zones are somehow going to be harmful to business. In every single case I know about in these three countries, these car-free zones are thriving. They're booming economically, and more merchants want to be part of them. Another sort of dramatic example, this is in Freiburg, Germany, again in the southwest part of Germany. This is the scene, avant. This is in the 1950s, 1960s. You can see there's a car bridge, basically. To the right, this is the scene today, and you can see it's been turned into a bicycling bridge. Now, this didn't take any money. I mean, if you look at those two, I mean, there hasn't really been anything done to the bridge. It's just that the space has been taken away from the cars and given to the bicyclists. Why not do that here in Vancouver? I mean, why not? Honest. Everyone talks about, oh, it's so expensive to provide facilities for cyclists. Well, this didn't cost anything. Just take it away from the cars and give it to the cyclists. I mean, there's a very simple solution to that. Another example here is a case of the 1960s, where you have, I mean, from my point of view, a very ugly sort of a streetscape. You have cars parked on the sidewalk. You have a very unpleasant environment. It's been trapped. Virtually every residential street in Freiburg has been traffic calmed in exactly this way, so that it becomes a bikeable street without, I mean, they have lots of bike lanes and bike paths as well, but for all residential streets, you have maximum speed limit of 30 kilometers an hour. You have, as you can see, various kinds of infrastructure changes on this street, which is not the case for all streets, but it has made it a very, very pleasant street. Again, this is not by chance. This is not historical. This is a deliberate policy shift where this city said, we're for people, we're for cyclists, we're for pedestrians, and we're against cars, sort of. Or at least we're in favor of taming the car. It's not that we want to banish it completely from the face of the earth. Actually, I would like to. But I dare not admit this publicly. But what you do need to do is tame the automobile. Control the automobile and say there are certain places, situations, and times when you just don't want the car to be dominating your entire life, your entire neighborhood. And this has now been turned into a very pleasant and safe residential neighborhood. One of the reasons that the Danes, the Germans, and the Dutch cycle so much, and also walk and take transit so much, is because it costs a lot more to fill up with gasoline. And it's about twice as much as it costs here in Canada. These prices have all increased, as you know, in the last year. I actually wouldn't know because I don't have a car. But at any rate, I know they have increased. But the Europeans, Northern Europeans, are paying roughly twice as much per liter in gasoline, about $2 per liter. It's about $1 per liter, I guess, here. But again, more. And this is in US dollars, by the way. And we're paying even less in the United States. Now imagine, you know, if you were paying, say, $2, $3, $4 a liter for gasoline, I'll bet you'd think twice about getting in that car. I mean, people, for better or worse, they're selfish. I mean, every single one of us is self-centered to some extent. We're going to do things that are in our own self-interest. And let me tell you, if you make the cost of parking your car, buying your car, running your car, and so forth, very expensive, you're certainly going to encourage more walking, cycling, and transit use as well. So that certainly is another key. And I think Americans, as well as Canadians, are terrified somehow politically of restricting car use, of imposing higher taxes on car use. I mean, in every American state, it's like, as you know, two of the three major presidential candidates now want to eliminate the tax on gasoline altogether to get more votes. So it's a very difficult political thing to do, but it's certainly, in both the UK and in Germany and in some of these other countries as well, they explicitly imposed an annual increase in the gasoline tax. They called it the environmental surcharge every single year. So there was a regular increase in the tax on gasoline so that, and people could predict this. They would, well, in 10 years, gasoline is going to be more and more and more expensive, and they could then learn how to ride a bike. Or walk more, buy better walking shoes. And almost all the difference, by the way, in the price of gasoline is due to taxation. It's not because of differences in the base price of petroleum. It's because these countries have made the explicit policy decision of making gasoline more expensive, and by doing that, discouraging car use and encouraging walking, cycling, and transit, and using the humongous revenues from that to help finance those facilities. So it's sort of a doubly beneficial impact. Okay, wow, we better get going here. Well, what are the other things that these countries do to encourage more cycling and making it safer? Well, the obvious one, I'll go to each of these in more detail, better cycling facilities. More cycling facilities and better cycling facilities, which I will go to in some detail, but also that includes making all roads more bikeable, fixing up the potholes, fixing up the drain grates, wider curb lanes, and so forth and so on. Traffic calming of residential neighborhoods, I will show you some examples of this. Integration of cycling with public transport, restrictions on car use. I would like really to ban it completely, but at any rate, restrictions especially in central areas and in residential neighborhoods of car use, Traffic education is key. Traffic regulations and enforcement, absolutely key. Mixed-use zoning and improved urban design. Why is that important? Because if you have relatively compact development with mixed uses, you're going to have shorter trip distances, getting from home to work, to school, to shopping, and so forth. So it's really, really key to have effective land use planning that ensures mixed-use development and compact development. That I will not be illustrating, but the other ones now I will illustrate. Okay, better cycling facilities, car-free zones. Car-free John, of course, has to be in favor of car-free zones. Well, this is the main street in Münster, Germany, city of about 250,000 people, and you can see no cars, but you have bicyclists, you have pedestrians, and in the background you'll see a bus as well. So they really allow all three of the so-called green modes of transportation, but they eliminate the car. It's simply not possible to drive a car on the main street. This is in Amsterdam, and here you have, in the middle of the car-free zone, you have a special two-way, bi-directional bicycling facility, and you have pedestrians on both sides. And as I noted yesterday, that sign, that coffee shop, you do not go in there. It is not Starbucks. Do not expect coffee in the coffee shop. No. You get something else. Actually, I must tell you, I had a colleague who went into one of those Amsterdam coffee shops, and she ordered a glass of wine. And the person, you know, who was at the counter said, "We don't serve hard drugs here." Oh, well, that's sort of an aside. Okay, anyway, this is another example of a car-free zone in Freiburg. They allow these three modes together. They coexist in harmony. Public transportation, you have a tram line, you have a cyclist, you have the pedestrians. It's a very pleasant zone. Almost no injuries of any kind. Somehow they manage to get together along. It's not like with get along together. It's not like with cars that are running over everyone. Another kind of a cycling facility, which I don't think I've seen anywhere here in North America, and that is a so-called Fahrradstraße, or bicycling street. These are in many, many German cities and also in Dutch cities. In Münster alone, there are, I think, 25 of these bicycling streets, entire streets that are mainly devoted to cycling. Not bike paths, but entire streets, as you can see here on the slide. And this is generally a narrow street, not built this way, but it was just always this way historically, a narrow street. And cyclists have priority over the entire width of the street. Cars are allowed on these streets at the mercy of cyclists. They may not rush the cyclist, they may not beat their horns at the cyclist, and if you hit a cyclist on this street, you're in big trouble. So this is, again, this you can see the sign here, Fahrradstraße, that cars are allowed, but they're mainly meant for cyclists. Berlin, an example. This is a city of about 3.5-4 million people, the biggest city in Germany and the capital, of course. They have about 1,000 kilometers of cycling facilities. They have quadrupled the extent of their cycling network over the past 20 years, or very similar to what Germany as a whole has done. But the interesting thing about Berlin is that they have 4,000 kilometers of traffic-calmed streets. Now, when I say traffic-calm, this is a speed limit of 30 kilometers or less. So something like 90% of all the residential neighborhoods in a big, big city, such as Berlin, are traffic-calmed. So you have 1,000 kilometers of separate cycling facilities, plus 4,000 kilometers of very cyclable traffic calm streets, you've got 5,000 kilometers of very, very good cycling routes. This was my favorite bike path of all the bike paths that I've ridden on in Germany. This was a circumferential beltway in Germany. What they had done, they tore down the old town wall, 6 kilometers in circumference, and they built this, instead of building a roadway, which most Americans or maybe Canadians would also do, they built a bikeway. And then on both sides of the bikeway, as you can see here, there are separate pedestrian paths. And just to show you how thoughtful they are, on the left-hand side is a hard walking surface, and on the right-hand side is a soft walking surface, just to give pedestrians the choice, one or the other. This is not recreational cycling. I would say 95% of the trips on this facility, and I think it's 70 or 80,000 trips a day, are to get to the university, to get to school, to go shopping, to visit the theater, or whatever it might be. It's not recreational. It connects many, many, many different cycling paths and lanes from the outskirts of the city into many, many paths and lanes going into the center of the city. So it basically serves the same sort of a function as a highway would of this sort, of a beltway, but of course it's in the form of a cycleway. It's a very, very pleasant facility, as you can see. You have something like this. Isn't this on the seawall? So it's somewhere. It's here in Vancouver. And so this is also an example of a good facility in that it separates the pedestrians and the cyclists. I mean, you can't always do this, obviously, but it avoids certain conflicts that may arise when you try to mix the pedestrians and the cyclists. This is one of my favorite ones. I couldn't believe that they do this. This is in Odense, Denmark, and they have this special vehicle with laser technology that actually detects in advance possible problems with the underlying surface of bikeways and bike lanes. You can see here, if you look very carefully, you can see in front of this the bicycle symbol on the lane. And they actually have this go around regularly to detect in advance, sort of proactively, any possible problems with the bikeway network. In addition to which, they have a team of four cyclists who are paid to find obvious defects in the cycling network. So again, I don't know about Vancouver, but we don't have those sorts of things in American cities, eh? Another thing you can do in terms of cycling facilities, introduce contraflow lanes. So where cars can only go in one direction, allow bicyclists to go in both directions, and when the bicyclist is going in the reverse direction to the motor vehicle traffic, introduce this special sort of a contraflow lane. These are examples in Toronto and in Melbourne. You have sort of adjustments like this to give more flexibility to cyclists. In this case, it's in Burnaby, and it allows the cyclists to go through the arterial and get onto the other side, whereas cars cannot go through that passageway. This is an example. This is in Munster, again, a city I love because I lived there for 2.5 years. But the point is, bicyclists are allowed to do almost anything, and cars are allowed to do almost nothing. I think that's sort of a good balance there. But this is an example, to the lower right here, of a very, very typical, it's called in German, falsche Einbahnstraße, which is a false one-way street. It means almost all of the one-way streets in these cities are two ways for cyclists. And that's exactly what the sign says, that cars cannot go in that particular direction, bicyclists can go in either direction. Likewise, there are many false dead ends for the cars, whereas the cyclists can go through. So basically, giving as much route flexibility and directional flexibility as possible for the cyclists and restricting car use as much as possible. This is another example of that kind of a thing. This is a cut through here for cyclists in Melbourne. I was there 2 years ago. And you have these sorts of cut throughs here in Vancouver as well. So you can certainly do it, but do maybe a little bit more of it. Other kinds of cut throughs. The one on the left, I think, is sort of interesting. It's a special kind of a shortcut for cyclists. Normally in Munster, you have one-directional bike paths on the sides of every single arterial, almost without exception. In this case, it turns out because of the particular routing of most cyclists, they made it bi-directional on one side to avoid detours by cyclists, which raises an important point. How is it that cities, for example, in Denmark or the Netherlands or Germany, come up with all these great ideas? It's because in this city, the mayor, who is a woman, is also a cyclist. The majority of the town council is cyclists, and they get to their town meetings by cycling. All the transportation planners for the city are cyclists. Now, folks, you got to understand, if the mayor is a cyclist, the town council gets to the meetings by cycling, and all the town planners and transportation planners are cyclists, they are going to be very sensitive to what works and what doesn't work. They're going to have all sorts of natural ideas because every single day they're using these facilities. If something doesn't work, they're going to make it better. They're going to correct it. They're going to experiment with things and advance the state of the art further and further. This slide I wanted to show because my European colleague insisted that I do it. He said, I want you to show your audience there in Vancouver that we have excellent cycling facilities, not just in the center of the city, but that as a matter of local ordinances, they're required in every single new suburban development. So that from the very get-go, from the very beginning of the development, you have sidewalks, you have bikeways, bike paths, and so forth, and that's really important. So even in these suburbs, as part of the local ordinance, you're required to have these facilities. Another important point that I think makes cycling facilities especially high quality and usable and convenient in all of these European cities, and that is they form a comprehensive, integrated complete cycling network. This is Freiburg, Germany, maybe 180,000 population, and what's shown here in red are only the completely separate facilities, the paths and the completely separate lanes. It's not showing the traffic calm streets, of which almost all streets are traffic calm. You can see it's a complete network. There's almost no gaps in the network. You can get from almost any point in the city to almost any other point in the city on a completely separate facility, if that's your preference. You also have to provide crossovers of rivers and so forth with very nice bicycling facilities. I think you might consider putting in bridges like this. I sort of like these ped bike bridges. They're very, very convenient, in both in Germany and also here in Melbourne, where I was cycling. You have some of these going over arterials here. This one is in New Westminster. And I understand it helps you get from one side of the arterial to the other in this particular case. But I somehow don't like the idea of facilitating sort of cars just staying at the same level. It's almost, I think, more for the convenience of the cars than it is for the convenience of the cyclists. The cyclists having to go up and around and down and around. Again, better than nothing, that's for sure, because you really want to be able to cross over the arterial. But why not make the cars go under, oops, or over? I get very dramatic because I get involved in this. Anyway, just an idea. Here's the bike path. It's really important to let bicyclists get across bridges, such as here on the Lions Gate Bridge. Another idea here, if you have a lot of bodies of water and you want to facilitate cycling, you don't have room on the edges of the water. For example, here in Brisbane, along the river was already very dense development, and they simply didn't have space to put in, to tear something down and put in a new bike lane or a bike path. What they did instead is they instituted this very, very nice floating bikeway. Traffic signals. As I've said before, encouraging cycling is not just a matter of funding. It's also a matter of giving priority in time. To whom do you want to give priority? Why not give the advanced green light to the cyclist? Because that's what's done in all of these cities. At almost all the intersections, the cyclist gets the advanced green light and the motorist has to wait. You can't tell that just from looking at all of these slides, but that is the point of all of these slides. That in every case, the cyclist is getting the advanced green light and is getting through the intersection before the car. That is certainly something that makes cycling safer and more convenient. It's safer because the cyclist is in the line of sight of the motorist. It's faster because you're getting through the signal. You're getting the advanced green lights, or you're getting through the intersection faster. Now, the Dutch have experimented with various different designs of bicycling facilities. Every facility, no facility is perfect. Every facility has advantages and disadvantages. One of the problems with bike ways that go along the side is that if you're making a right-hand turn as a motorist, you might not see the cyclist soon enough to avoid a collision. So in this particular case, the Dutch have experimented with this design. They have the bike path veers a little bit to the right, and then you see the motorist is forced to make a very, very sharp right turn. Those yellow bollards there are forcing the motorist to make a very sharp right turn, forcing the motorist to slow down. The cyclist is forced to slow down. So both the motorist and the cyclist slow down. They have more time to see each other and to avoid each other. The Dutch have found this to be very, very effective at reducing the problem of collisions in this sort of an intersection. The other thing you can do, another kind of an innovation, as it were, and the Dutch are full of innovations when it comes to cycling, and that is you put the bike path around the back of the bus stop, so you don't have a conflict between bus passengers getting off a bus and the cyclists coming alongside. This is really a problem in many American cities. I'm not sure how much of a problem it is here in Canada, but it's certainly a big problem in the U.S. Oh, this is another one of my favorite slides. This is one of my favorite intersections here in Munster, and you can see there are two aspects to this particular design. Again, one of the key things you want to design for is not just the bike path along the street, but also what do you do at intersections? It's really, really key. Well, what is done here in Munster, Germany, is first of all, the cyclists get an advanced stop line. So you can see that they can go much, much closer to the beginning of the intersection than the cars can. You can't see this, but the sign just to the right. You see, they have a special lane, first of all. They have a special bike access lane to get to the front of the intersection. There's a sign there with a little red dot, and it says, when there's a red light, cyclists should fill up the entire space in front of the cars. Then cyclists get an advanced green light, And as you can see in the right-hand part of this picture, they are then almost through the intersection before the cars can even start. Again, it's safer, it's more convenient, it's more pleasant. It's a much, much, much better situation as to how you'd handle intersections. And these kinds of intersection modifications are done all the time in all of these cities. You do have bike boxes here in Vancouver as well, but I don't think I've seen any. I think I was told there's one advanced green light for cyclists somewhere here in Greater Vancouver, but not many of them. I don't think I would say at every intersection. The other thing you can do here in terms of highlighting safety is when a bike path crosses the intersection and has to be obviously then a bike lane over the intersection, they highlight this with a very, very bright red coloring of this lane. Again, it's a signal to motorists, watch out. Cyclists are crossing here. Do not hit them. And they don't. They're unlike in New Jersey, where motorists aim for cyclists. Actually, German motorists are trained not to do that. But even in North America, in Portland here, you have some very nice bicycling intersection facilities where you have cyclists triggering the green light to go through the intersection. And in fact, they call this the bike scramble, I think as they call it. But you can go to the right, to the left. It's an all red light for motorists. And so basically the cyclists can go anywhere they want to go. But it's been very, very effective, very popular. You have something similar, not the bike scramble, but you have also these sensors in the pavement for cyclists here. This one in particular is in Richmond. These are two examples of shortcuts for cyclists. These are both in Odense, Denmark. Instead of forcing the cyclist to come all the way to the intersection, you have these shortcuts so they, before they even get to the intersection, they can take a right-hand turn. And they've interviewed the cyclists and they love it. They say, you know, they think it's safer, it's more convenient, and so they've been putting more and more and more of these sort of shortcuts at the intersections for the right-hand turns. And then when you have a T intersection, they of course allow the cyclist to go through the red light. But one of the neatest things is the green wave. Because this is in Denmark, there are several cities that have the so-called green wave. They synchronize the lights such that at the average cycling speed that the cyclist will always get the green light. But one of the neatest things is, if you see those bollards to the right of that bike path, what you'll see is that the green lights pulsate at exactly the speed the cyclist needs to keep up in order to get green at every intersection. Now, you've got to admit, that's pretty neat. Or as my friend Peter Jacobson in California says, cool. But I think that's the, I mean, not only that you have it, but then they actually facilitate you to keep that speed. And then on the right, they actually have a digital readout of exactly what your speed is and so forth. And they have different speeds, by the way, for different kinds of routes. So for long distance commuter routes, they tend to be a higher synchronized speed. For shorter distance routes in the city, they're shorter, lower speeds. This is the same sort of a thing, but without the fancy technology. This is the green wave in Copenhagen. Very, as you can see, very intensively used. Traffic calming is also an extraordinarily important form of bicycling facility, as it were. I've already mentioned this before, but of course you can do it either with just a sign that says, okay, maximum speed is such and such, or you can try to force cars to slow down through various kinds of physical infrastructure measures, speed humps and bumps and mid-block closures. And I'm not advocating all these things because they're not all bicycle friendly, but many of them are bicycling friendly, and you can certainly design traffic calm streets such as they are bicycling friendly. Just some examples of very, very simple, inexpensive forms of traffic calming. This is probably the most typical kind of traffic calming in German cities. I mean, there's very little done here. Look at that. That's not an expensive anything. All they've done is put in these two big bollards. And other than that, the sign on the bottom, they painted on the roadway surface. This sign actually indicates that the speed limit is 7 kilometers an hour. Now, truly, the sign, as you can see, there's someone, you know, there's a kid playing with the ball, there's a pedestrian, there's a car. It's implicit that the cycling is possible. But what it's saying is everyone has the equal right to use this road. This is not a road for cars. We will tolerate cars, but it's also for children playing in the street, for pedestrians, for cyclists. And folks, what they found in German, Dutch, English, and Danish cities is that when you introduce traffic calming, it reduces pedestrian and cycling fatalities by a range of 60 to 80%. So even if your goal is not to increase cycling, if you care about kids, and they're the ones, by the way, who are most injured on residential streets, if you care about kids and you really want to focus on increasing the safety of children, traffic calm your streets. It's a dramatic safety improvement. But of course, it also facilitates cycling. And every study I have seen shows that it increases both the amount of cycling and the safety of cycling. So this is, again, a very cheap, very simple way of making your neighborhoods more livable, less noisy, less polluted, and also much safer and bicycling friendly. And by the way, she's not wearing a helmet either. This is another example of traffic calming. This one's only 30 kilometers an hour, so it's not as extreme traffic calmed. But you can see it's a very nice design to that street. It certainly has narrowed the street. They've taken away an entire lane, actually, away from the cars, and they've forced them to slow down. Lots of cycling on this particular sort of a street. This is another design of a traffic calm street. This one, again, that sign is up there. So in German, it's called eine Spielstraße, which means literally a play street, but it means a street that's shared by all of these different users. And you can see that you don't even have to have a sidewalk. That it's understood the motorist has to respect. It's as if the whole thing is a sidewalk or a mixed-use path, mixed use for all modes of transportation. And they found, and this is really, really important, in every single case where they have introduced this sort of traffic calming, it has so dramatically, dramatically reduced fatalities of every kind. Here you have an example of sort of pro-bike traffic calming here in Vancouver. So the bike basically can go, I believe, here in both directions, and the cars only in one direction. Another example of traffic calming in Vancouver. Something you can also do, this is something they've been doing in Portland, the bicycling boulevards. Very, very little in the way of infrastructure modification, but they've been very successful, actually. Portland has, I believe, it's tripled its share of bike trips over the past 10 years or so, and one of the techniques they've used is this notion of a bicycling boulevard. So rather than having, I mean, they also have vastly expanded their separate cycling facilities, but they've also had this whole system now of bicycling boulevards. Very, very convenient and inexpensive way to promote cycling. Bike and ride, really important. So you have to provide bike parking spaces at train stations, key bus stops, let people take their bikes on the trains, on the buses, and so forth. This, I've got to show, this is the main bike station at the main train station in Munster. 3,500 bikes. They have medium-term parking, long-term parking, short-term parking, bike repairs, bike rentals, and they also have a bike wash. Now, folks, that's pretty neat. I think that's pretty neat. And this is bike parking at one of the bus stops in Munster. So, I mean, it's not just at a main train station. That's actually, I think, very, very attractive bike parking. You do have to pay, I'm not sure exactly what it costs. It's not much, whatever. It's like a monthly fee, sort of rented by the month. But at the same, you're given alternatives. You don't have to use a pay parking. You can use some of the regular parking to the upper left there. And it's also fairly high quality parking, sheltered. You have parking here at a bus stop this is in Burnaby, and in this case it's secured parking down here, but it's not quite as attractive, I don't think, as what I just showed you in Munster. This is parking at Odense, Denmark, same thing, very normal, but one of the things that's sort of weird is there's very, very few bike racks on buses in these European cities. For the most part, people will ride their bikes to a major bus stop, then get on the bus, get off the bus, and then have another bike at the other end and ride from there. Same thing with train stations. Buses now with TransLink have the bike racks, which is a good thing, that's for sure. The other thing is, that, again, this sort of my theme here is take away from the car and give to the bike. And in this case, for every parking space for the car, you can create 10 parking spaces for bikes. So why not do it? I mean, you're getting 10 for the cost of one. And the mayor of Munster, who is a cyclist, said, I don't like cars, and I believe we should send the signal that we prefer cycling. Cycling is more environmentally friendly, it's energy efficient, it's better for our town, it makes us more livable, more sustainable. And so she deliberately, as a matter of policy, was able to get lots of car parking spaces taken out and substitute for them bike parking. And you can do this, this was done in San Francisco, the same sort of ideal, but more modern. Another idea is once you have these facilities in place, whether they're bike lanes, bike paths, traffic calm streets, now you have to give people the information, okay, where are those facilities and what's the best way to use them? In Berlin, just as one example, there are many German cities that offer this, but as one example, in order to take into account the different needs, the different preferences of different kinds of cyclists, they let you input your preferences. So what is your desired speed of travel? Do you have to go very fast, or are you perfectly happy cycling very slowly? Do you want to cycle on the most direct arterial streets, or would you prefer the quieter residential or secondary streets? What kind of pavement? Does it have to be a paved facility, or can it be an unpaved facility? What kind of mix of traffic do you feel comfortable with? Do you want on-street lanes, or do you insist on off-street paths? You input each and every one of those, and of course your origin and your destination, and this is what you come up with. It shows you in red, this is, given your preferences, which may be very different from someone else's, given your preferences, this is your preferred route. You then click on, this is all in German, sorry, but you click on the icons, and it tells you exactly where the bike parking is. It tells you where all the transit connections are. It tells you what the total time of your trip will be. It tells you what the average incline of your trip will be, and so forth. And the number of traffic lights, it tells you that as well. I mean, that's pretty nice. And if that's not good enough, in Odense, Denmark, you can do it on your cell phone, which is very handy, I think, because, I mean, you know, on the one hand, you can sit at home and plan your whole trip out, but isn't it handier to have the cell phone there, and while you're on the way, you can sort of, well, maybe I change my mind, I want to go here now. Susan Handy took these photos again last summer when she was in Copenhagen. I think it's really, really important to have good signage. I mean, not just good maps and good internet planning, but once you're on the route, to have really clear, attractive, consistent, uniform signage for bike routes and bike ways and so forth. And this is very clear. It also shows then the connections to mass transit here on the bottom, the nearest bus stop, the nearest train station, and so forth. On the right, I think is also a neat feature here, you have a bike counter. So every time a bicyclist goes by that particular column, you have it, it goes up and it counts up, 799, 800, 801, and so forth. And it's sort of neat. I mean, okay, it's not absolutely necessary to get people cycling, but it's certainly, it's sort of one of the neat promotional gimmicks or gadgets or whatever. It also gives them information, though. It helps them plan. It counts the number of cyclists so they can determine, okay, do we need to expand this facility? So it's attractive, it's sort of interesting, it's intriguing for the cyclist, and it also, as you get a higher and higher number, you sort of see the success. But it also does help in terms of cycling, planning the facilities. Giving people free air pumps here, I think, is a really convenient thing, especially when you get a flat tire. Now, cycling can also travel, just as we want to make cycling possible for a wide range of social groups, we want to make it possible for a lot of different trip purposes. In the United States, almost 80% of bike trips are recreational. Most of those, what happens is, Americans sort of put their bikes on the top of the car, and they go out to the countryside. And then they feel good about themselves, you know, and they say, oh, I'm doing something good for the environment. Of course, they're driving out to the countryside to use the bikes. And, you know, I understand recreational cycling can be a lot of fun, but that's not the kind of cycling that's going to reduce greenhouse gases. If you really want to do something to meet the Kyoto Protocol and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and help the environment and reduce congestion and parking needs and so forth, you're really going to have to deal with serving more utilitarian trips, daily travel, trips to work, trips to school, trips to shopping and so forth. And that's where, if you look at the Denmark or the Netherlands, something like 70% of their trips. In Denmark, 90% of their trips are utilitarian trips. And we didn't believe that figure. Linda Christensen, who's the head of statistics for the Danish Ministry of Transport, we emailed back and forth and back and forth. I just don't believe it. How can 90% of your bike trips be utilitarian? Don't you do any recreational? And she said, here in Denmark, we take bicycling seriously. We want to do things with it. You know, we just don't go bicycling for recreation. We want to get places. So whatever. So I still can't believe it, but she said the overwhelming majority, at any rate, of bike trips in these European cities is, in fact, for practical utilitarian purposes. And those are the kind of trips that are going to help substitute for the car trips. So from that point of view, they're really important. This is an example. This is called the Christiania bike, but I had to show this. It's sort of neat. You see these all over Copenhagen, a number of Danish cities. Bicycling, police on bikes, I hope they bring these back here in Vancouver. They still have them in Toronto, and a number of lots and lots of cities in Europe have the police on bikes. But I think it sends a signal. It's saying cycling is legitimate, and we're even going to put police on bikes, hopefully to catch the motorists, not other cyclists. But anyway, I think it's important to send that signal. deliver mail on bikes. There's lots of things you can do with bike. Even UPS by bike. I mean, why not? It's a lot better than these diesel fumes I get from the UPS trucks coming by. You also, now I'm almost finished now, but you need to provide these facilities, give people the information, integrate cycling with public transportation, but then also explicitly market cycling to different groups. Because different groups have different needs, and you need to realize those different needs and focus on those different needs by a differentiated marketing campaign. So, to the youth, yeah, this is in Odense, Denmark, they have the cycling ducky. Now, come on, folks, doesn't that turn you on? Look at that. I mean, balloons and the cycling ducky. If I'd been a kid, it would have turned me on at any rate. And so kids are very young. They sort of already at that very, very young age try to attract kids to cycling. When kids get a little bit older, they get a little bit competitive. They want to, you know, be in contests. And so then you have these sort of cycling contests with medals and certificates and so forth. The other key thing here in terms of targeting it to different groups, you got to be sure that kids are able to cycle effectively and safely. And one of the ways that German, Danish, and Dutch cities do this is they require that every kid, almost every school, by the third or fourth grade, has to complete a course in safe and effective cycling. And what happens is there's actually a real traffic policeman who takes the kids first to a test course, which this is in Berlin here to the upper left. So that you don't see anyone there because it's all fenced off. It's really just a test course. But first, the traffic policeman takes the kids on this course, explains all the signs, the ways to turn, where to look, and so forth. Then takes the kids out onto the real streets with live, moving traffic. And they do the same sorts of things once the kids have a little bit of experience. Then the kids get tested. They get a certificate. They get a pennant. They get a sticker for their bike. It's a big deal. But what does it mean? That already by the third or fourth grade, every Danish, German, and Dutch kid, whether a girl or a boy, knows how to cycle safely and effectively. So from the very youngest age, these kids are able to get around by bike, and they better be able to, because almost all of them get to school by bicycling or by walking. And that's an important thing also, getting kids sort of into the habit of cycling. What about when we get older, like me? Oops, there, I better be careful about this. I get too excited about these things. You can see here in Vancouver, and not just in Vancouver, in Toronto, many other cities here in Canada as well, there are special cycling courses for adults who want to either relearn cycling or learn cycling for the first time. Don't just write them off. Just because we're older doesn't mean, you know, you can throw us out. Take into account also these people who are getting older but who have these mobility needs. I mean, really, as we're getting older and older, many people keep driving their cars when it gets more and more and more dangerous. And so you really have to ensure that as we get older, we do have options, whether it's walking or cycling or taking public transportation, but at least make this a possibility and offer older adults this possibility of taking up cycling at an older age. And this is done here in Vancouver. Another important aspect of making cycling possible and safe for everyone is make sure motorists don't run you down. And we're almost at an end now, but each of these photos is actually from the official German driver's license test. My German doctoral student and one of the co-authors actually of this PowerPoint downloaded this from the official website for the German driving test, so for an example. There are a set of multiple choice questions that are associated with each and every one of these photos. And they ask, what are you supposed to do as a motorist vis-a-vis each of these photos? In every case, the right answer is yield to the cyclist, yield to the pedestrian, yield to the cyclist. The lower right might be a puzzle. It was pretty obvious to me, these three. The lower right, I was puzzled. I said, Ralph, what's that about? I don't quite understand that. You have a kid on a bike who's over there on the sidewalk. I don't understand what's the point of that. What kind of a question is that? And he said, in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Denmark, also in Belgium, by the way, turns out by law that it is your responsibility as a motorist to anticipate possibly dangerous situations where a child or an elderly cyclist could dart out into that roadway and you might hit them. It is your fault as a motorist if you hit that child cyclist. And it is your responsibility in advance, proactively, to anticipate the possibility that that kid might dart out into the roadway, and it is your fault by law if you hit that kid. And Rail, this German doctoral student of mine, failed the German driving test twice because he did not actively demonstrate that he was taking into account the possibility of maybe endangering a child or elderly cyclist. I mean, I wish that motorist training were that strict in New Jersey, where the motorists are truly homicidal. But this is important. It really is important. It's one thing to train cyclists to cycle safely, but equally, if not more important, is training motorists to drive in a way that does not endanger cyclists. I mean, in some cases, motorists are driving because of they're not aware of the needs of cyclists, or they're not on the radar screen, or whatever it is. In other cases, as in New Jersey, you have some truly nasty motorists who are trying to drive the cyclists off the road. They think it's their roads. Whichever it is, I think that motorists really need this sort of very strict motorist training before they get their license. And by the way, the license ought to be taken away if they're ever caught endangering cyclists in this way.
And that, of course, was John Pooker ending his talk rather abruptly there. I did miss the very end of the talk, so you could catch that from the website that we sent out, the very last bits of his summation of the talk. He's a professor of urban planning at Rutgers University, and as I was mentioning, you can find a video of his presentation or the slides that accompanied this talk that you just heard from a link on our website at coopradio.org/redeye.